last time we talked about the problem of having a lot of information and figuring out ways that we can represent that information in sort of concise and meaningful ways. And if you recall, one of the principles was how can we find representations where the solution to a problem or a question makes itself evident? And so today, what I want to do with this first lecture on information visualization is talk about some of the more famous visualizations and sort of what principles they illustrate. And so what I really want to get, what I really want you to get out of this lecture is to understand how visualizations can play a role in decision making. Obviously, in certain business situations, this is important, but also in day-to-day life, how constructing visualizations can make our lives, they can make it more efficient in certain ways. Okay, so next slide. Learning objectives. I want you to be able to understand the utility and problems of geovisualizations. So geovisualizations are cool, but there are certain problems inherent in them. So I want you to be able to see what these things are by the end. Describe the role of visualizations in decision making. You should be able to critique visualizations based on distortions in terms of causality, data density. And be able to describe the data ink maximization process. And so I'll give you one example of how this sort of plays out, but I think it's kind of intuitive when you see it. And then I want you to be able to know what small multiples are and how they actually work. And then finally, I want you to sort of identify and understand what the Schneiderman principle is. So Ben Schneiderman is one of the really famous guy in HCI, in particular information visualization. He has a very simple principle for designing interactive visualizations, which none of the ones I'm showing you today are. So we'll save that one for next time. All right, next slide. So this is a geovisualization that was constructed a long, long time ago. And at the time, there were a lot of people dying from cholera. If you look at this visualization, if you actually zoom in on it, what you actually see is this is a street map, essentially. And then there's sort of kind of like a bar chart, sort of. And the bar chart comes out of different parts of the street. And these represent different houses, essentially. And the bigger the bar, obviously, on the house, the more people that died from cholera. So at the time, the theory as to why or how cholera was transmitted was something known as miasma or bad air. And they believed that sort of rotting material sort of emanated kind of bad air. And if you kind of inhaled this rotting material, then you would essentially get cholera. And so there's no such thing at this time as germ theory. That is the notion that microorganisms can cause disease, right? So that's something that comes as a consequence of some of this work early on. So I want you to flip to the next slide and zoom in. And this zoom in is on one area of the map. And what you can see is that there is a lot of deaths happening kind of at one house. This is if you look for the label Broad Street, there's a lot of deaths at this one house. This is technically a geovisualization where the data is sort of grounded geographically. A lot of the time, data doesn't actually work this way, and we use space kind of in an arbitrary way. But here, it actually is grounded in very concrete, geolocated sort of way. So some of the things I think I want you to notice here are that there are no deaths at the brewery, which I think is funny. And it turns out that the water pump that is that these houses are getting water from, it turns out that this is where the cholera is being spread. It turns out that the pump handle is actually dirty. It's contaminated with cholera. And so if you actually go back one step, you can actually see the locations of the other water pumps as well. You got to zoom in a little bit, but they're sort of like little circles, and I think they actually say pump next to them. And you can see that there aren't very many deaths at those other places. And so here's an instance, basically, where this geovisualization or, organizing the data in terms of the geography actually helps us to figure out what's going on. It's all centered around this pump. So if you hit the next slide, visualizations that we see are often designed to tell a particular story, and that is definitely the case in this previous slide with this cholera thing. When you create a visualization, it also tells a story, but you need to be careful of the story that you're telling, right? So if you take a look at this comic, You can see concentrations of our site's users. So imagine this is some guy telling you, they've constructed a website for you and they're doing a business analysis case, right? So our site's users, this is the heat map. Red means a lot of people coming from here. Subscribers to Martha Stewart Living, and here's the heat map. And also consumers of furry pornography, also heat map, right? The thing you'll notice, obviously, is that these are all the same, right? So you need to be careful when you're constructing these things, these visualizations, because often they imply a certain causality. And if causality really isn't there, then you're actually lying with your visualization, right? These relationships can sometimes be spurious, meaning they just happen to be. And sometimes they don't really fit or make sense if you really think about it. And in this particular case, obviously in this comic, it really doesn't make any sense at all. All this is just a population map. So you need to be careful about what your visualization is actually implying, right? So if you have the next slide, this actually tells you what graphics and visualizations are actually doing. Obviously, they're showing you the data, but the point is that they shouldn't get in the way of the message of the data. So last time I showed you a couple of visualizations where there were some graphics on the visualization that didn't need to be there, right? The chart junk. That actually gets in the way of the message. And the reason it gets in the way of the message is not just because it's lying, but because if there's more ink and there's more information on the visualization, that is actually taking away our ability to interpret what's happening, right? Remember that each additional element on a screen takes time to interpret, right? So obviously you want to avoid distorting the message. You want to avoid distorting the data, right? One of the reasons you use visualizations is because large data sets are really hard to interpret. When you have a lot of numbers, it's hard to make sense of what these numbers may mean. On the other hand, having it as a visualization sometimes helps, right? Particularly when the data set is very large. If you have good visualizations, it allows you to compare across different data sets. And hopefully it gives you the ability to get fine detail on a particular element. And it also allows you to kind of see a broad overview of what's going on in the data. And then finally, of course, visualizations, you want it to have a purpose. I think this kind of sort of goes without saying. You wouldn't do it if you didn't think that it had a purpose, obviously. So as I said, these are the kinds of things that visualization should be doing for us, right? So what I'm going to do is I'm going to walk you through a couple of visualizations and show you how actually they do or they don't support certain principles. If you hit the next slide, this is something of a visualization that was constructed by Florence Nightingale. And what's happening here, and actually, so I'll give you a little bit of time to explain how this diagram works. So it actually starts on the right side rather than the left side, right? So what you're looking at is the number of deaths and the causes of deaths in the army in the East. And so there's a Crimean War, and this is tracking kind of the passage of the war and how people are actually dying. So each of these wedges represents a different month. And the war actually starts right there at 12 o'clock on the right side pie, okay? And the different wedge colors actually represent different numbers of deaths, okay? So blue, the light blue, represents the number of deaths that are from preventable or mitigable zoonotic diseases. These are things that you could, if you washed your hands before you got into the next patient, they wouldn't die from it, right? So infections, essentially. Red represents deaths from wounds, and the black wedges represents all other deaths in the army, okay? So what you can see, obviously, is that as soon as the war begins, there are a lot of deaths due to these kinds of infections, right? Lots of blue deaths in comparison to the black ones and the red ones. And in fact, sort of the red ones and the black ones, they stay more or less constant. The red ones, obviously, grows when there's a war, but the black one actually more or less stays relatively constant, particularly in contrast to the blue one. Just so it's clear on how to interpret this, let's just take a look at the let's pick one here, the September wedge of 1985. Okay, so this is sort of the between 2 and 3 o'clock on the right side. There's a red wedge, and then there's a blue wedge. So the way to interpret the blue wedge is that the blue one is strictly from the edge of the black there right to the end. So the blue isn't the whole pie slice, okay? So now the utility of this visualization was that at the time you had a lot of people that can't read data. They also can't read. But visualizing it this way helped to tell the story and helped to make the case. So I want to tell you that this is an impressive visualization, but it lies a little bit. And I want you to think about why that is and have an answer ready for class. You can contrast that to the next chart that basically shows the same data but in a slightly different representation, right? So here what's happened is the black has been replaced with this dark purple. But here what has happened is rather than actually showing it as these kind of like circular charts, what they've actually done here is they're showing it as kind of like time kind of flowing from left to right. And so each month kind of represents a different bar in the chart. Okay, so I want you to see that and think about how this representation varies from the previous one. Obviously, there's some differences. And how is it better and how is it worse? And then I want you to take a look at the last visualization that's on slide number 9 and notice how this visualization is actually different from the previous one. What you'll see is that there's a lot of distortion going on when you have the sector or the pie slice visualization, right? The area is sort of deceptive a little bit. The other thing with the stack chart is that you end up with an inability to sort of interpret certain colors because they're stacked on top of others. And one way to see this is to imagine what that chart would look like if light blue was underneath and everything was on top. Okay? So think about how these three different charts compare and think about what they're good for, essentially. What are these three different variations of these charts good for? All right, so next slide. Tufte talks about a thing called graphical excellence. And in the back there, that's a chart that we saw last time. Right. So what you want to be doing when you're constructing visualizations is something where you construct something where the viewer gets the greatest number of ideas in the shortest time with the least amount of ink in the smallest space. So this is how to make your visualization effective. Right. This is sort of a measure of optimality. Right. So obviously, if I get a lot of ideas from looking at this, or I can think about a lot of different things, that's a good thing, right? That's high bandwidth. If I can do it in a short amount of time, again, this is related to bandwidth, right? If it takes a lot of time to figure this stuff out, that's not a good thing. If we can do it with very little ink, sort of the number of pixels is one way to think about it, then that's a good thing. And if we can do it in a small space, that's another great thing because it means that we can increase the bandwidth in the display overall, right? So the next slide, how we represent information needs to be useful. So this is something that you frequently see when you take a look at the elections and or any election, really. This particular chart, this is from an XKCD comic, and what he's critiquing is the kinds of charts that you see on TV when they're comparing kind of Democratic votes and Republican votes. And he's basically saying that this kind of chart is more or less useless because you can't compare between these two things. All you can see is where you are and where things need to be for a particular side to win. That's basically all you can see from this thing, right? You can't tell. You can kind of tell that the red bar is a little bit shorter than the blue bar, but that's about it. You can't tell how many seats that actually represents or where these seats come from or anything, really. So the representation you choose actually matters. So if you contrast this, for example, to something where you have the red bar and the blue bar actually starting from the same baseline, this obviously facilitates comparison. So if you hit the next slide, another one of Tufte's principles is data density. And this is related to that graphical excellence optimality thing. Data density. Graphics are at their best when they represent very rich and dense data sets. Tufte defines data density as follows. Data density is equal to the number of entries in a data matrix divided by the area of the graphic. So I kind of showed this last time with the Napoleon's March visualization. Again, there was a lot of data being represented in there. Now, if you were to flip it up, you'd see that it actually represents things like how many deaths there are, or how many people are living, how many deaths there are, how that changes over time, how that changes in comparison to where they are as they march, and also changes in comparison to sort of time over time, right? So it's showing a lot of data in a fairly reasonable area. So that's the point. And so Tufte actually believes that that is a great example of data density. Some examples of low data density in the next slide. So here's one in terms of, so this is a graphic pulled out from the executive office of the president. And what's going on here is total population in college or university in adult education. So these are percentages. But basically, this is very low data density because it's representing basically three values. And that's it. And it's using all of this space. In contrast, if you look at the next slide, this is an example of very high data density. So here, what they're charting is sort of weather in a year in New York. And you can actually see how much, you know, sort of what the variation in temperature was in comparison to sort of what it typically is. It also shows you how much rain there has been and what that is in comparison to usual, and also the relative humidity over time. So you can actually see that there's a lot of data points being represented in this chart. And one way to think about this is how many data points is being are being represented per square centimeter. And in this case, quite a few, and in the previous case, not very many. One more example of high data density. So if you take a look at the next slide, this is the number of this is sun observations in a year. So every time you have black, basically, this is when the sun actually shows itself. Okay, so the dotted line represents the sunset and the sunrise, and then between then, when do we actually see the sun? So presumably they had a sensor somewhere that could detect actually sun, and what this visualization shows us is, you know, where the sunny days were, obviously, and also you know, how much sun you get during the summer versus how much sun you get in the winter. And then finally, it also shows you where cloud cover was, right? So if you look at the beginning part of November, lots of cloud cover throughout a good chunk of the month, basically. Right? So kind of cool. And again, lots of data being represented kind of on a per square inch basis. If you take a look at the next slide, this is a stem leaf plot. I think this is kind of cool and a really useful technique. It's a visualization technique that allows us to sort of recover the original data, which is what's really neat. So the data itself doubles as a visualization in terms of how it takes up space. So this plot shows you volcanoes, heights of volcanoes, and it's in units of 100 feet. So the way to interpret it is this, right? So if you have 19 and bar and then 3, that represents one volcano that has a height of 19,300 feet. Okay, so if you just, you know, so you can actually go and recover some of the data here, right? We can actually see that there are volcanoes of 900, 800, 700, 600, 600, 500, 600, and 200 feet tall. And then you can actually go and see, oh, actually, there's a lot of volcanoes that are of sort of 5,000 feet or more. At about 5,000 to 6,000 feet, and a lot of volcanoes that are at 2,000 feet, right? Between 2,000 and 3,000 feet. So it's kind of cool how you can sort of recover data that way while still allowing the data to sort of be, if you squint at it, you can see it. So hopefully that makes some sense. So this is what's called a stem leaf plot. I think it's just very, very clever. If you take a look at the next slide, here's a way that you can actually use the stem leaf plot. So these are bus train times. This is the kind of thing that you would get if you pull up the schedule for, I don't know, the C train or one of the Calgary Transit buses, right? When does this bus actually come by this stop? You know, get all the times. In Japan, they actually represent this in a different way. And I'll argue that this is far more compact and shows you a lot more information on a per inch basis. So what it is this is a stem leaf plot, okay? And I would say that this is very efficient use of ink. The left side is for trains that are going one way. So these are actually the ones that are going towards downtown, sort of. And on the right side is trains that are going home from downtown. The middle column is the hour. So the train runs basically from 5 a.m. up to about just past midnight, it looks like. And then the times are the things that are being listed here, right? So you can see that there are trains kind of going to downtown as early as 4:52, from downtown as early as 4:52, but then at 5:25, 5:47, right? This tells us a lot of information that we cannot actually glean from the previous representation, where you have all of those times kind of written down. Without really, really careful examination. And I would argue that with the previous representation, that is the one that's on slide 17, it's basically impossible for you to get a lot of this information out of that chart. Because here you can see things like, sort of between 7 and 8, everybody's going downtown, everybody's going to work, and there are a lot of trains. There are more trains going to work between 7 and 8 o'clock than any other time. The trains coming the other way, it seems to bulk up between 5 and 8 o'clock or so. And there are more trains kind of heading from downtown back into the suburbs there. So this is these are some cool things that you get out of the stem leaf plot. That is that you can see this sort of overview stuff very easily. Okay, so next slide. Along these lines, then, you can see that there's this notion, you can see what a data ink ratio might be, right? So the way to think about it is it's data ink divided by the total ink to print the graphic. And obviously here he's talking about sort of static graphics. And you can this ink doesn't really cost us anything in terms of pixels. Like obviously turning on one pixel and turning off another pixel doesn't cost us anything. But he's really talking about it in terms of the cognitive principle, right? We want to have high data ink ratio so that people are not wasting their time interpreting things that they don't need to interpret. Right, so data ink ratio, another way to think about it is the proportion of graphics ink devoted to non-redundant display of data information, and it's 1 minus the proportion of the graphic that could be erased without loss of data information. And so your goal is to maximize the data ink ratio and to remove non-data ink within reason. So Tufte actually kind of walks us through an example of how he goes about doing this. And there is a certain art to it, obviously, which is what makes it kind of tricky sometimes. But if you kind of watch what he's doing and think about, the data that he's taking away, it kind of makes a little bit of sense. So I'm going to be talking about sort of the next, looks like next 5 slides sort of. So I'll flip us through as we go. So slide 20, this is essentially the atomic elements. Is that what they're called? Atomic elements? I don't know, whatever, elements. You can see the atomic volume and the atomic number. And what you can see is that there's a bit of periodicity here, right? This is something that we would have remembered from, whatever, chemistry 10, chemistry 9, something like that. And this is fine, right? This is the kind of representation that you'd probably come up with if somebody told you to graph these things. Now, what Tufte actually does, if you hit the next slide, is that he basically says, hey, look, there's all this non-data ink here in this slide that, in principle, maybe we can actually get rid of. So he's showing you the original, and now he's showing you some of the non-data ink. And the next figure, what he's done is he's taken away some of that non-data ink, and he's basically saying, hey, is the underlying structure not still here? Like, can we still see the data? And I think part of the answer is, yeah, we can actually still see basically what's going on. In the next slide, what he says is, well, actually, there's still some non-data ink here. Those are those dotted dashed lines. Maybe we actually don't need to have those there. And so he takes some of these curves away. Part of the problem when you take this curve away, though, is that it actually takes some of the structure away, and that may not be desirable. So maybe we might put them in a little bit later. Part of the reason why some of the structure is gone is because we actually can't see necessarily which dots are next to each other and sort of how high they are. So maybe we should put in back some of those. Maybe we should put back some of those grid ticks. So if you hit 24, slide 24, you can actually see this is with some of those grid ticks back in there. But here's a great example of how the non-data ink actually takes away from our ability to interpret and see some of this data ink, right? These pluses make it hard to see some of these dots. And so maybe the grid ticks are kind of overwhelming and annoying. So let's take those away. And so actually in the next slide, Tufte actually does this. He takes away those grid ticks. He puts the dashed lines back in. And these represents, obviously, each of those periods. And the other thing he does here is he actually annotates. And he says, hey, here are the beginning parts of the first element in each one of these periods, right? And then he actually labels them so we can actually see what these things are. So if you take a look at the next slide, this is all of those six charts kind of in sequence, and you can see kind of what he's taken away, what he started with. And he would argue with you, he would argue that essentially what he's done is he's done a very good job of only retaining the ink that you absolutely need to get the message. And the message is that there is a periodic thing that is happening here. One of the other things that Tufte talks about, so sorry, we're on slide 27 now. One of the other things that Tufte talks about is comparison. So he often says that one of the things that we're trying to do with visualizations is to compare between data sets or compare between partitions of the data set. And he thinks that this is at the heart of sort of quantitative reasoning. So what he does is he introduces this notion of small multiples. And this is something you've seen before, so don't worry. But the point of small multiples is to visually enforce comparison of changes, of differences among objects, and of scope of alternatives. It turns out that small multiples are really good because they allow us to compare between things really, really easily. So if you hit the next slide, this is an example of some small multiples. So what they're doing here is they're trying to see how monthly unemployment rates change across time and across different states in the U.S. And you can see that some states have some serious periods going on here. Other states don't have it kind of happening quite as much. And so we'll talk about this a little bit in class. But what you can see is when you've got all this data kind of like right next to each other, kind of in small form, it's actually very easy to see how these things compare with one another. So if you hit the next slide, this is basically what small multiples are. Sets of small thumbnails, some thumbnail-sized graphics on a single page that represent different aspects of a single phenomenon. And this helps you to answer the compared to what question through repetition. So it does this through repetition. And so typically what you do is on the x-axis or the y-axis, you actually have it vary with some other variable. In the previous case, these are just states. So you don't have much opportunity to do that. What does it do? Uses the same measure and scale. So that's something that you want to be able to do. It invites comparison, shows a range of options. And on computers, you can do this rather than using space to do this, you can actually do this by using overlays. And you can actually cycle between them. So you can use animation to help you see differences between some of these variables. So that's kind of cool. So that's how small multiples work. In the class, I'll talk through a couple more examples of these because they're kind of neat. Sparklines, slide 30. This is something else that Tufte came up with. He's saying that the problem is that the visualizations sit apart from the text. And so his basic idea is that sometimes we need to see the data or the visualization of the data within the context of the text, and it helps us to interpret what's going on. And so here is an example of sparklines. I think this is from Google Analytics. So if you use Google to sort of track visitors to your web page and stuff like this, you can actually see these sparklines. And the point is that they actually can become part of the text flow. They're sort of memorable, they're concise, and they're located in line at the same height as the text. So for example, just seeing 961 visits, that's fine, except for it doesn't tell us kind of how we're doing right now in comparison to the past, right? So you can actually show this little chart that's next to 961, and you can actually embed that in some text, and that helps us to interpret the data or the text right there. If you take a look at the next slide, these are some examples of sparklines. And in this case, he's not using a sparkline kind of in line with text in the same way, but it's still kind of cool. You can see how it sort of works out. What's happening here is he's charting Major League Baseball wins by different teams within each sort of division. And then you can actually see sort of how teams end up faring over time. So this is kind of a really compact chart that shows you that allows you to compare between different teams, and it allows you to see kind of what these teams' trajectory was over time. So you can see that the New York Mets, for example, this is one of the ones in the National East, so it's on the top right-hand corner. It's 1, 2, 3, 4, the fourth team down. They were actually doing well until about the three-quarter way through the season, and then they just, like, stank, and they just got owned towards the end. In the same way, you can probably see, if you look carefully, you'll find certain teams that turned it on right at the end of the season that ended up doing really, really well to finish off the season, and other teams that just sucked the whole way through. Next slide. This is something similar to a spark line. This is just another representation showing you wins and losses for specific teams. And here on the top part of it, those are wins. On the bottom part, obviously, those are losses. And you can see where the wins happened for a team and where the losses actually happened for a team. And this allows you to see, in sports terms, this allows you to see where the team was being consistent and when it wasn't. Okay, next slide. Last thing that Ben Schneiderman talks about, so we think of this as the Ben Schneiderman principle, is that he's one of these guys that's really interested in interactive visualizations, so not just static ones, as I've shown you to this point. So visualizations that change as a consequence of our interacting with them. And I'll show you a couple examples of this in class. And he says that basically when it comes to interactive visualizations, you need to do two things, or three things. You need to be able to show an overview. You need to be able to zoom and filter, and then you need to be able to extract details on demand. So I guess that's four different things. So overview, zoom and filter, and then details on demand. This is the thing that he talks about all the time. So I suppose one way of seeing this is looking at how Google Earth works. This is not perfect, but it kind of illustrates the basic idea, right? So if you use Google Maps. So if you're using Google Maps and you're looking up a destination, and you're looking for some directions, it gives you some pieces of information, right? It says, oh, if you take this route, it's going to – so here I'm trying to get from the University of Calgary to McDonald's, right? So it says basically if you take this route, you're going to drive for 5 minutes. It's going to take you – you're going to drive for 2.3 kilometers. If you take this route, you're going to drive for 6 minutes, and it's going to be 2.7 kilometers. So notice that what's happening here is we're zoomed up pretty far away. So this is just giving us some overview information. It's giving us no detail, right? And then it's only when we zoom in on one particular route that we actually get the detail. So if you take a look at the next slide, now I've zoomed in and asked for detail on this particular route, and it's saying, okay, well, here's the actual detail of the route. These are the actual little streets that you'll drive on, so on and so forth. So this is not the best example of visualization, but it's one that is quite common, obviously, in your everyday life. Okay, so with this, I've basically talked about information visualization, give you kind of an intro, and talked about some of the more famous visualizations and how they work.